But this is not true. Fishermen use horsehair, taking it from the manes of stallions, since the hair of mares, once wetted with their urine, becomes weak and brittle. Aristotle, however, says that nothing clever or unusual is meant in these matters, but that in fact a small piece of horn is placed in front of the hook along the line, since fish coming for something else would otherwise bite through it. As for hooks, fishermen use the round ones for mullets and amias, since these fish have small mouths and are wary of anything too straight. And often, even suspecting the round hook, the mullet swims around it in a circle, batting the bait with its tail and snatching up whatever is knocked loose. And if it cannot manage even that, it draws its mouth together and, pursing its lips, touches the bait only with the tips and nibbles a bit off it. The sea bass, more manfully than the elephant, for it is not another creature but itself that it draws the barb from, once it has become caught on the hook, pulls the hook out on its own, widening the wound by turning its head this way and that, the wound, and enduring the pain from the laceration, until he casts out the hook. The fox shark, for its part, does not often approach the hook but avoids the trap. But once caught, it immediately turns itself inside out, for by its strength and suppleness it is able to twist and turn its body, so that what was inside becomes outside, and the hook falls away. These cases, then, display an intelligence that is resourceful and remarkable in making use of opportunity for its own advantage. But other creatures show, along with intelligence, a sociable and mutually affectionate nature, as with the anthias and the parrotfish. When a parrotfish swallows a hook, the other parrotfish nearby leap up and gnaw through the fishing line, and when one of their number falls into a fish trap, they offer their tails to it from outside, and it eagerly bites hold and they pull it out together. The anthii help a fellow of their kind still more boldly. Laying the line along their back and setting the spine upright, they try to saw through it and cut it with its roughness. And yet we know of no land animal that dares to come to the aid of another in danger. Not a bear, not a boar, not a lioness, not a leopard. They will indeed gather together in the same place in the arenas, animals of the same kind, and circle around one another. But none knows how, or has the sense, to help another. Instead, each flees and leaps as far away as possible from the one that has been wounded and is dying. As for the story about elephants, my friend, those that carry earth into pits and haul up one that has slipped down by means of a mound of soil, it is extraordinary and strange indeed, and, coming as it does from the books of Juba, seems to command belief as if by royal decree. But being true, it shows that many sea creatures are in no way inferior in sociability and intelligence to the wisest of land animals. But there will perhaps be a separate discussion of their sociability. Fishermen, seeing that most fish parry the cast of the hook as if by countermoves in wrestling, have turned to force instead, netting them as the Persians do, on the ground that once creatures are caught in a net, there is no escape for them through reasoning or cleverness. With casting nets and creels, gray mullet and rainbow wrasse are caught, as well as mormyris, sarg, gudgeon, and sea bass. And the fish called the sinkers, red mullet, gilt head, and scorpion fish, they draw in and enclose with trawl nets and seine nets. Homer was therefore right to call this class of net the all-catcher. But against these two, the dogfish have their devices, as does the sea bass. For on perceiving that it is being dragged along, it forcefully splits and pounds the ground, hollowing it out, and once it has made room by the sweeping motions of the net, it thrusts itself in and clings there until the net has passed over. A dolphin, when it is enclosed and perceives that it has come within the embrace of a seine net, stays put without being disturbed, but rather rejoices, for it feasts without effort on the abundant fish that are present. But when the net comes near land, it eats through it and departs. But if it fails to escape in time, the first time nothing terrible happens to it, instead the fishermen stitch bulrush cords through its dorsal fin and let it go. And if it is caught again, they punish it with blows, recognizing it by the stitch marks. This rarely happens, however, for having been pardoned the first time, most dolphins learn their lesson and are careful thereafter not to offend again. And since there are many further examples of caution, forethought, and evasion, it is worth not passing over that of the cuttlefish. For it has, near its neck, the so-called sac full of a dark fluid which they call its ink, and when it is being caught, it discharges this fluid outward, contriving thereby, once the sea has been darkened, to create darkness around itself and so slip out from under and escape the eye of its hunter. Imitating the gods of Homer, who often, hidden in a dark cloud, spirit away and steal off with those they wish to save. But enough of these examples. As for their cleverness in attacking and hunting, one can observe the ingenious tricks of many creatures. The starfish, for instance, knowing that whatever it touches dissolves and melts away, relaxes its body and lets itself be touched by whatever swims past or comes near. You surely know the power of the electric ray, which not only numbs those who touch it directly, but even through the heaviness of the net, induces a numbness in the hands of those who take hold of it. Some report, having tested this further, that if it is thrown out still alive and water is poured over it from above, one can feel the numbing effect running up to the hand and dulling the sense of touch, apparently because it is transmitted through the water, which is affected first. Having then an innate awareness of this power, the ray never fights anything face to face or takes such a risk. Instead, circling around its prey, it scatters its emanations like arrows, first poisoning the water and then, through the water, the creature itself, which is thereby unable either to defend itself or flee, but is caught fast as if bound in chains and grows numb. The creature called the fisherman, anglerfish, is well known to many, and it got its name from what it does, a device which Aristotle says the cuttlefish also employs. It lets down from its neck a tentacle like a fishing line, one naturally suited to stretch far out when relaxed and to contract back into itself again quite easily when drawn in. So whenever it sees one of the small fish nearby, it lets the fish bite at it, and then little by little draws the line in unnoticed and reels it closer, until the thing that has taken hold comes within reach of its mouth. As for the octopus's change of color, Pindar has made it famous, saying, "Adapt your mind, above all, to the color of the sea creature, and mingle with every city as it appears to each, and Theognis likewise. Have the mind of the many-colored octopus, which takes on the appearance of whatever rock it clings to. For the chameleon changes color not through any contrivance or in order to hide itself, but simply changes under the influence of fear, being by nature timid and easily startled. This goes along with its being, as Theophrastus says, full of air. For the animal's whole body is very nearly one great lung, from which one may infer its airy, pneumatic nature, and hence its readiness to change. With the octopus, however, the change of color is an act, not a passive experience. It changes deliberately, using it as a device to escape the notice of what it fears and to catch what it feeds on. By deceiving them, it catches some creatures that fail to flee, and itself escapes others as they pass by unaware. The claim that it eats its own tentacles is false, but that it fears the moray eel and the conger eel is true, for it suffers badly at their hands, being unable to do anything to them since they slip out of its grasp. Just as, conversely, the spiny lobster easily gets the better of those same eels once they are in its grip, for their smoothness does not help them against its roughness, but is destroyed when the octopus wraps its tentacles around and forces its way in. This cycle and recurring round of chasing and fleeing one another nature has made into a kind of competitive training and practice for them in cunning and intelligence. Moreover, Aristotle related a certain foreknowledge of winds possessed by the land hedgehog, just as he also marveled at the triangular flight formation of cranes. I, for my part, offer as evidence not some particular hedgehog from Cyzicus or Byzantium, but all sea urchins together, which, when they sense that a storm and rough sea are coming, ballast themselves with small pebbles, so that they are not overturned by their own lightness nor swept away once the swell arises, but stay firmly fixed to the little rocks. The changing of the cranes, flight direction against the wind, is not peculiar to that one kind of creature. Rather, all fish alike, with similar understanding, always swim against the wave and the current, and take care that the wind, if it should come from behind, does not ruffle open their scales and so hurt the body by exposing and roughening it. For this reason, they always keep themselves oriented head-on into the current. For the sea, being split in this way along the crown of the head, presses down the gills and, flowing smoothly over the surface, keeps them close and does not raise the roughness. This, then, as I said, is common to fish, with the exception of the Elops sturgeon. This fish, they say, swims with the wind and current, not fearing the ruffling up of its scales, since its scales do not overlap toward the tail. The tuna, moreover, has so keen a sense of the equinoxes and solstices that it can even teach a person, without any need of astronomical tables. For wherever the winter solstice overtakes it, it stays still and remains in the same spot until the equinox. But clever, too, is the crane's grasping of a stone, so that when it lets the stone drop, it is repeatedly woken up. And how much cleverer, my friend, is the case of the dolphin, for which it is not permitted to stand still or cease from motion. Its nature is perpetually in motion, and the end of its life and the end of its movement coincide. Whenever it needs sleep, it raises its body up to the surface of the sea, then lets itself sink down on its back through the depths, lulled to sleep by a sort of gentle rocking swell, until it strikes and touches the bottom. Waking up in this way, it darts off with a rush, and once back up at the surface again, lets itself sink once more, and so is carried along, contriving for itself a rest mixed together with motion. They say tuna do the same thing, and for the same reason. Now that I have just finished describing their mathematical foreknowledge of the sun's turning points, to which Aristotle is a witness, hear next about their skill in arithmetic. First, though, by Zeus, let me mention their skill in optics, of which even Aeschylus seems to have been aware. For he says somewhere, having turned his left eye aside like a tuna. For tuna are thought to be weak-sighted in one eye. Hence, when they enter the Black Sea, they keep the land on their right, and the opposite when they go out, very sensibly and intelligently always relying, for the safety of their body, on their better eye. As for arithmetic, tuna have needed it seems, on account of their sociable and mutually affectionate attachment to one another, and have reached such mastery of that science that, since they thoroughly enjoy being raised and gathering together in schools, they always arrange their numbers into a cube-shaped formation, forming a single solid body out of all of them, bounded by six equal square faces. And they then swim maintaining this formation, so that the whole block presents an even, symmetrical front on every side. At any rate, the tuna watcher, if he accurately counts the number visible on the surface, can immediately declare the size of the whole school, knowing that its depth is arranged in a rank equal to its breadth and its length. Indeed, it is this schooling behavior that has given the amia its very name, and I think the same is true of the young tuna Pelamis as well. As for the other kinds that are seen living together sociably in schools, one could not state their number. Rather, we must turn instead to their individual partnerships and forms of cohabitation. Among these is the pinnegard pearl mussel crab, which used up so much of Chrysippus's ink, holding pride of place in every one of his books, both on natural philosophy and on ethics, for he never learned of the sponge guard, since he would not have left it out if he had. The pinnegard, then, is a crab-like creature, so they say, which lives together with the pinna mussel and, sitting in front of it, guards the entrance, keeping the shell open and gaping until one of the small fish that they prey on falls in. Then it bites the flesh of the pinna, which prompts it to close the shell, and together they eat the catch that has now been enclosed within their fence. The sponge, meanwhile, is driven by a small creature that is not crab-like, but rather resembles a spider. For the sponge is not lifeless, insensate, or bloodless, but though it is attached to rocks like many other creatures, it has its own motion, internal to itself, when that needs, so to speak, prompting and guidance. Being otherwise porous and left slack in its openings through sluggishness and dullness, whenever some edible thing enters, it closes up and consumes it once its guardian gives the signal. Still more, when a person approaches or touches it, being informed and alerted, it bristles, so to speak, and closes its body up, making it dense and firm, so that cutting it free is easy enough for its harvesters, but slow and laborious. Purple shellfish, gathering in colonies, build a comb in common, like bees, in which they are said to breed. They take up the edible mosses and seaweeds clinging to their shells, providing one another a kind of banquet passed round in turn, each grazing on what is on the outside of the next. And why should one marvel at sociability in such creatures, when even the most unsociable and beastly of all the animals that rivers, lakes, and seas nourish, the crocodile, shows itself remarkably capable of partnership and mutual favor in its dealings with the plover. For the plover is a bird of the marshes and riverbanks, and it guards the crocodile, not out of its own free provisioning, but being fed on the crocodile's leftovers. For whenever it perceives, while the crocodile is asleep, that the mongoose is plotting against it, smearing itself with mud and dusting itself off against it like an athlete, it wakes the crocodile with its cries and pecking. And the crocodile has grown so tame toward it that it opens its mouth wide and lets it inside, and takes pleasure as the bird gently picks out and probes with its beak the small scraps of flesh caught between its teeth. And when it has had enough and wants to close its mouth, it tilts its jaw and gives a signal, and does not let it fall shut until the plover, perceiving this, has flown out. The creature called the pilotfish is small, about the size and shape of a goby, but its surface, on account of the roughness of its scales, is said to resemble a ruffled bird. It always keeps company with one of the great sea monsters and swims ahead of it, guiding its course, so that it will not run aground on rocks or fall into some shoal or strait from which escape is difficult. For the sea monster follows it, obediently guided, as a ship follows its rudder. As for anything else the monster takes into its gaping mouth, animal, boat, or stone, everything sinks in and is at once destroyed and lost. But the pilot fish it recognizes and takes up inside its mouth, as if it were an anchor. For the pilot fish sleeps within it, and the sea monster stands still and lies at rest while it rests. And when the pilot fish sets out again, the monster follows after, never leaving it by day or by night, or else it wanders aimlessly and goes astray, and many such monsters have perished, driven ashore like rudderless ships. Indeed, we ourselves witnessed such a case near Antisira not long ago, and it is recorded that earlier, when one ran aground and rotted not far from Baone, a plague resulted. Is it, then, worth comparing to these partnerships and mutual dealings the friendships Aristotle records between foxes and snakes, on account of their having the eagle as a common enemy, or those between bustards and horses, because the birds enjoy coming close to horses and scratching through their dung? For my part, I do not see so great a mutual concern even among bees or among ants. For they all together promote the common task, but no individual gives any particular thought or care to another individual as such. We shall see this difference still more clearly if we turn our discussion to the oldest and greatest of social works and duties, those concerning procreation and the rearing of offspring. First, those fish that graze in places bordering on lakes, or that take shelter in rivers. Fish that live in the sea near lagoons or in waters fed by rivers, when they are about to give birth, run up into the fresh water, pursuing the gentleness and stillness of the fresh streams. For calm is good for giving birth, and freedom from predators is found together with lagoons and rivers, so that the offspring are preserved. This is why the greatest number of births and the best occur around the Euxine Sea, for it does not harbor sea monsters, but only a scrawny seal and a small dolphin. Moreover, the mingling of the rivers, since the largest and most numerous empty into the Pontus, provides a mild and suitable blend for those giving birth there. But the case of the Antheas is most wonderful, the fish that Homer calls sacred. Some think that sacred here means large, just as they call a certain bone the sacred bone because it is large and call epilepsy, being a great disease, the sacred disease. But others take it, in general use, to mean the fish that is released and consecrated. Eratosthenes seems to mean the chrysophres, the golden-browed, when he speaks of a sacred fish with golden eyebrows. Many mean the elops, since it is rare and not easy to catch. It appears often around Pamphylia. Whenever the fishermen catch one, they crown themselves and crown their boats, and they are received with clapping and applause and honored as they sail in. But most people believe that the Antheas is called sacred, and is in fact sacred, because wherever an Antheas is seen, there is no dangerous creature about. Sponge divers dive down with confidence when it is present, and fish give birth with confidence, as though they held a guarantee of safety. The reason is hard to determine, whether the predatory creatures flee the Antheas, as elephants flee the wild boar and lions flee the cock, or whether the fish, being intelligent and possessed of memory, recognizes and keeps watch for signs of places free of predators. But the forethought for their offspring is common to all fish that give birth. The males do not eat their own young, but even linger by the spawn, guarding the eggs, as Aristotle has recorded, and those that follow the females sprinkle their milt upon the eggs little by little, for otherwise what is born does not grow large, but remains incomplete and stunted. The wrasses, for their part, fashion something like a nest out of seaweed and wrap it around their spawn, sheltering it from the surf. As for the dogfish, its affection surpasses that of any of the tamest animals in sweetness of disposition and kindness toward its young. It first produces an egg, then the creature not outside but inside itself, and so nourishes and carries it as though from a second birth. When the young grow larger, the mother releases them outside and teaches them to swim nearby. Then again, she takes them back into herself through her mouth and offers her body to them as a dwelling place, providing at once room, nourishment, and refuge until they are able to help themselves. Wonderful, too, is the tortoise's care in the matter of birth and the preservation of her offspring. She lays her eggs after coming up close to the sea, but since she cannot brood over them nor stay long on dry land, she buries the eggs in the sand and heaps over them the smoothest and softest part of the beach. When she has covered and hidden them securely, some say that she scratches and marks the spot with her feet, making it recognizable to herself. Others say that the female, being turned about by the male, leaves behind distinctive marks and imprints of her own. But more wonderful still is this. Having watched for the 40th day, for it is in that many days that the eggs are hatched and burst open, she approaches, and each mother, recognizing her own treasure, opens it gladly and eagerly, as no human being opens a chest of gold. As for crocodiles, the rest is much the same, but regarding the location, no reckoning gives a person insight into the cause, nor any process of reasoning. Hence they say that the foreknowledge shown by this creature is not rational but divinatory. For the crocodile lays her eggs neither farther nor nearer than the point to which the Nile, when it rises, will flood and cover the land at that season of the year, so that any farmer who comes upon the eggs both knows for himself and tells others how far the river will advance that year. In this way she has calculated it so precisely that, without the eggs being wetted, she herself, once wetted, may still brood over them. If the young are stolen, then whichever hatchling, as soon as it emerges, fails to seize something at hand in its mouth, whether a fly, a little worm, a piece of earth, a twig, or a blade of grass. The mother tears it apart and kills it with a bite. But the spirited and active ones she cherishes and looks after, exactly as the wisest of men think proper, apportioning her affection by judgment, not by mere feeling. And indeed seals give birth on dry land, but little by little they lead their pups forward and give them a taste of the sea, then quickly bring them out again, and they do this repeatedly, in turn, until the young, becoming accustomed in this way, grow confident and come to love the life of the sea. Frogs, for their part, use summoning calls in their mating, producing the sound called the ololigon, which is an erotic and nuptial cry. When the male has thus drawn the female to him, they remain together through the night, for they cannot mate in the water, and by day they are afraid to couple on land. But once darkness has fallen, they come forward and mate without fear. At other times, they make their voice ring out in anticipation of rain, and this is counted among the most reliable of signs. But dear Poseidon, what an absurd and laughable thing has just happened to me, if, while lingering over seals and frogs, the creature most wise and most beloved of the gods among the animals of the sea has escaped me and passed by unmentioned. What nightingales would deserve comparison, for love of music, with the halcyon, or what swallows for love of their young, or what doves for love of their husbands, or what bees could be compared to it for skill? Whose birth-giving, whose labor and travail has a god so honored? For they tell that only a single island received the birth pangs of Leto, but for the halcyon, when she gives birth around the solstice, the god stills the whole sea into windlessness and calm. Hence there is no other creature that people love so much, for whose sake they sail without fear for 7 days and 7 nights at the very height of winter, considering passage by sea at that time safer than travel by land. But if I must also say a few words about each of the virtues she possesses. She is so devoted to her husband that she consorts with him and welcomes his company not just at one season but throughout the year, and this is not from wantonness, for she never mates with another at all, but out of goodwill, like a wedded wife, and out of affection. And when the male grows weak and burdensome to accompany because of old age, she takes him up, carries him in his old age and nurtures him, never letting him go nor abandoning him apart, but taking him upon her shoulders, she carries him everywhere, tends him, and stays with him until his death. As for her love of offspring and her concern for the safety of her young, once she perceives that she herself is pregnant, she turns at once to the building of her nest, not kneading mud nor plastering it against walls and roofs as the swallows do, nor using many active parts of her body, as the bee does when it enters into the honeycomb, opening it up, where the 6 feet, all touching together, divide the whole vessel into hexagonal cells. The halcyon, by contrast, has a single simple instrument, a single tool, a single implement, her mouth, and no other assistant to her industry and skill. What she contrives and constructs with it is hard to credit unless one has observed it with one's own eyes. The thing molded, or rather built, like a ship, by her, alone among many shapes, resists capsizing and cannot be swamped. For she gathers the spines of the needlefish and puts them together, binding them to one another by weaving them, some straight and some crosswise, as though throwing a weft across a warp, making use of bends and turns through one another, so as to fit them together and produce something round and stable, elongated in shape, resembling a fisherman's wheel. When she has finished it, she carries it and sets it down beside the wash of the wave, where the sea, striking it gently, teaches her to repair and thicken whatever is not well fitted together, as she watches it loosen under the blow, while what is properly joined it compresses and binds fast, so that it becomes hard to break apart or pierce even with stone or iron. No less admirable than this is the symmetry and shape of the cavity of the vessel, for it has been made to admit only that one creature herself as she enters it, while to everything else it is entirely blind and hidden, so that nothing can get inside, from either the land or the sea. Now I suppose none of you has failed to see the nest, but for my part, having often seen and touched it, I am moved to say and sing. Once on Delos I beheld such a thing, beside Apollo's shrine. I mean the horned altar, celebrated among the things called the seven sites, because, needing neither glue nor any other binding, it has been fastened and fitted together solely from the right-hand horns. May the god be gracious, being himself something of a musician and an islander, to the celebrated sea siren, and kindly laugh off those questions which people ask in mockery, asking why Apollo, not even knowing, a red mullet, that Aphrodite, near the sea, makes her own rites and sisterhoods, and delights in nothing being slaughtered. At Lepsis, the priests of Poseidon eat nothing from the sea at all, while, as you know, the initiates at Eleusis hold the red mullet in reverence, and the priestess of Hera at Argus abstains from it in honor of the creature. For it is the mullets above all that hunt down and consume the sea hare, which is deadly to man. And for this reason, as creatures friendly to man and life-saving, they enjoy immunity. And indeed shrines and altars of Artemis Dictyna and of Apollo Delphinius exist among many of the Greeks. But the special place which the god has made his very own is where the descendants of the Cretans dwell, who used a dolphin as their guide. For the god himself did not swim ahead of the expedition, having changed his shape, as the mythographers say, but sent a dolphin to guide the men's voyage and brought them down to Sura. It is also recorded that the men sent to Sinope by Ptolemy Soter to fetch the statue of Serapis, Sotals, and Dionysius, when driven off course by a violent wind and carried, against their intention, passed Malia with the Peloponnese on their right, then wandering and disheartened, a dolphin appeared before their prow, as though calling them onward, and led them to safe harbors and to gentle anchorages of that coast where they might rest secure, until guiding and escorting the ship in this manner, it brought them safely into Sura. From this, they sacrificed a landing offering and learned that of the two statues they must take up and carry away that of Pluto, but make a cast of that of Cori and leave it behind. It was likely, then, that the god should also love the creature's love of music. Pindar, too, comparing himself to it, says that he is stirred like a sea dolphin, whom the lovely melody of pipes has roused in the windless swell of the sea. But it seems rather that its love of humankind is what makes it beloved of the gods, for it alone embraces man simply because he is man. Among land creatures, some cherish no one, and the tamest cherish only those who feed them out of need, the dog, the horse, the elephant, and those they are used to. Swallows, for their part, settle in among us to get what they need, shade and necessary safety, but flee and fear man like a wild beast. But to the dolphin alone, beyond all others, belongs by nature toward men that very thing sought after by the best philosophers, love without need. For needing nothing at all from man, it is nevertheless well-disposed and friendly to all, and has come to the aid of many. Of these, the story of Arion is known to everyone, for it is famous everywhere. But you, my friend, have opportunely reminded me of Hesiod's line. Yet you have not reached the end of your tale, for in telling the story of the dog, one ought not to have left out the dolphins. The dog's testimony was, after all, a mute one, barking and rushing with cries upon the murderers. Whereas at Nemea, when the body was being tossed about by the sea, dolphins took it up, passing it eagerly one to another, and set it out at Rheum, revealing it slain. Myasilus of Lesbos records the story of Annalus the Aeolian, who was in love with the daughter of Smintheus, who had been thrown into the sea by the Pentheliti in accordance with an oracle of Amphitrite. And Annalus himself leapt into the sea after her and was carried safe to Lesbos by a dolphin. And the goodwill and affection of the dolphin toward the boy of Iesus seemed, through its excess, to be love itself. It used to play with him and swim beside him daily, and let itself be touched at close quarters. Then, when the boy mounted upon it, it did not flee, but bore him gladly, turning and bending in whatever direction he inclined, while all the people of Iesus would gather together on the shore each time to watch. But once, when a great rainstorm fell together with hail, the boy, swept off, slipped away and died, and the dolphin, taking him up together with his corpse, drove itself along with him onto the land and would not leave the body until it too died, having judged it right to share in the death of which it seemed to have been, in part, the cause. And a memorial of this misfortune is stamped on the coinage of the people of Iesus, a boy riding upon a dolphin. From this story, the tale about Coiranus also gained credence, though it seems fabulous. Being a Parian by birth, he came upon a catch of dolphins at Byzantium, caught in a Seine, and in danger of being cut to pieces, and he bought them all and released them. A little while later, as the story goes, he was sailing in a 50-oared ship carrying men who turned out to be pirates. And in the strait between Naxos and Paros, when the ship capsized and the rest were destroyed, they say that he alone, a dolphin swimming beneath him and buoying him up, was carried to a cave on Sicinus, which is shown even to this day and is called the Cave of Coiranus. It is said that on this account Archilochus composed the line, "Gentle Poseidon spared Coiranus alone of 50 men." And later, when he had died and his relatives were burning his body near the sea, many dolphins appeared along the shore, as though showing themselves come to attend his funeral, and they remained until the rites were completed. That the shield of Odysseus bore the emblem of a dolphin, Stesichorus too has recorded. And as for the reason, the people of Zacynthus preserve the memory, as Critias attests. For Telemachus, while still an infant, as they say, slipped into deep water and was saved when dolphins took him up and swam him back to shore. And it was for this reason that his father had the design engraved on his seal and as the ornament of his shield, repaying the creature in kind. But since I said beforehand that I would tell you no tale at all, and I myself do not know how, in speaking of dolphins, I was carried unawares far beyond what is credible, running aground on Odysseus and Coiranus, I now impose the penalty on myself. I stop, for I am already talking too much. It is open to you, then, gentlemen of the jury, to cast your vote. But we, for our part, have long ago resolved upon the saying of Sophocles, for a speech, even when in dispute with itself, is still, fashions a middle ground uniting both. For if you two combine what you have said to each other and bring it together into a single argument, you will fight well in common cause against those who would strip animals of reason and understanding.